Welcome to In the Studio with a 21st century perspective on history's greatest rock albums.
Guitar up.
One, two, three.
Redbeard here with part one of the essential Stevie Ray Vaughan and Double Trouble as we celebrate the band's induction into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
My sweet little thing, she my pride and joy, she my sweet little baby, I'm my little lover boy. That's a close up, baby.
Yeah, Stevie, in playing with him, there was a thing about him that was very, very simple. It was like, if it felt good, then it was good. We was a very trust your instincts band. Spontaneous. Didn't matter if there was some little minor performance mistakes. If the spirit was there and there was fire and the feeling was good, then it was happening.
You can't change it. Can't rearrange it.
Hi, this is Thomas Shannon.
And I'm Chris Layton. In the studio for the best of Stevie Ray Vaughan and Double Trouble, part one.
Career struggle, tremendous early success, crushing despair and near death, recovery, redemption, and tragedy. All of these are components in the saga of Texas modern blues musician Stevie Ray Vaughan. But through it all, the thing that survives and speaks best for him is his recorded musical legacy. Stevie Vaughan grew up with his big brother Jimmy in the Oak Cliff section of Dallas, Texas. Stevie idolized his older brother's way with an electric guitar, and Stevie dropped out of high school to follow Jimmy south to Austin. It was there that Stevie Vaughan actually could see in person many of the blues masters whose records he had played endlessly on his big brother's record player as a kid. These original blues men had discovered an enthusiastic club owner in Austin's Clifford Antone, and in the mixture of native Texas and imported university students, an audience that appreciated authentic blues. It was the perfect situation for the teenage Stevie Vaughan to apply for an apprenticeship. He was paying dues by playing the blues nightly. And nobody bothered to check his ID at the door for legal age. Stevie Vaughan's guitar playing ability, even as an adolescent, was an all-access pass that would never be revoked until the day he died. Double Trouble drummer Chris Layton still remembers vividly the very first time he heard Stevie Ray Vaughan's guitar. It's the sound that would forever change Chris Layton's life.
First time I heard Stevie play, and I didn't meet him that night, but the first time I heard him play was at a place called Soap Creek Saloon in Austin, Texas. Drove up, got out of my car, and I could hear the band playing, but I heard this piercing guitar as if it was like outside and not even coming from inside. It was like drilling like right through the walls of the building. And I thought, wow, who is this guy? And It was Stevie. He was playing. I thought, he's remarkable. It was just, he was.
Double Trouble bass player Tommy Shannon, who had made entree into the big time with Texas blues rocker Johnny Winter way back in 1970. Tommy finds it coincidental where he later discovered an adolescent Stevie Vaughan.
It's really kind of ironic the way I met him. Before I met him, I was playing with Johnny Winter. And we broke up, and I flew back to Dallas, and this club called The Fog was our old hangout. That's where I met Johnny Winter. And I went in one night, and Stevie was playing. He's about 14, 15 years old. And there was all these big people around him, you know, and he just looked up to them. And a lot of them kind of treated him like a pest, you know. Later on, he said he remembered I was the only one that was nice to him. But he was incredible. I mean, I knew, even though he was just a little kid, that he had a special gift. I knew that.
Stevie Ray Vaughan and Double Trouble's big break came with a chance booking without any record contract at the prestigious Montreux Jazz Festival at Lake Geneva, Switzerland in 1982. Audience members David Bowie and Jackson Browne were so impressed that Bowie hired Vaughan as featured guitarist for Bowie's 1983 hit album Let's Dance, while Jackson Browne invited Double Trouble to use Jackson's recording studio. Tommy Shannon and Chris Layton recall their humble beginnings with Stevie Ray Vaughan in the studio.
We went to L.A. and we had 3 days, right?
Yeah, that's as it turned out is really what it kind of amounted to.
Yeah, and when it, like the second day we did 2 songs, and the last day we did 8.
What we did was we actually mounted like what was like a 2-week tour, with that being the objective, to do shows and make a little bit of money and end up in L.A. And be able to record. But Jackson gave us the studio time. In fact, Texas Flood is actually recorded on like pre-production recordings of Lawyers in Love. Over the top, it was used tape. So he threw that in too. I guess if you look deep enough, you'll find Lawyers in Love underneath Texas Flood.
Subliminal.
From Stevie Ray Vaughan and Double Trouble's debut Texas Flood in spring 1983, that's Pride and Joy. Their music, earthy and soulful, was in stark contrast to the highly synthesized, keyboard-heavy, modern chart toppers then, such as the Eurythmics, the Cars, the Police, Men at Work. Between the Texas Flood debut album and the high-profile guitar solos on David Bowie's Let's Dance album, Stevie Vaughan's guitar prowess was a calling card that preceded him. Here's legendary blues guitarist, singer, songwriter Buddy Guy.
Well, first of all, when you're a guitar player, those things come to you. We're almost like prize fighters, you know. You hear about this whatever weight division you're in, you hear about this guy coming before you get to him, you know. Yeah, I heard about him with the Davy Boy, and naturally, you know, I had been going down into Austin around Antone's, and that's why he went in there and started making his noise at first, I think. And his brother finally told me, Jimmy Vaughan, that he would let him use all the records that he would play, but he was hiding the ones on me from him. And we used to laugh about it before he passed away. He used to tell me, say something funny. Say, brother, every time I listen in the room, I hear something you're not giving me. And he had to steal the record of mine. And that's how he got a hold of my licks from there.
Buddy Guy felt that young Stevie Vaughan soaked up all of the blues masters that Stevie heard like a sponge.
Well, I got to know him as one of my best friends before he passed away, and he was so much like myself when it come to that. There wasn't anybody he didn't pick up on. You know, you could hear Otis Rush in him, you could hear a B.B. King on him, you could hear Elmore James on him, and he just went, and that's what makes a good guitar player, a good horn player, whatever. You know, you get them all, and you put them together. I guess that's why gumbo tastes so good, because you put everything in it.
W.C. Clark's Cold Shot. On the 1984 second album from Stevie Ray Vaughan and Double Trouble, that's Couldn't Stand the Weather. Up next, my first interview with Stevie while his star ascended rapidly, but storm clouds were developing on the horizon. Follow In the Studio on Facebook, at Redbeard Rocks on Twitter, and online at inthestudio.net. I'm Redbeard. You're in the studio for part one of the essential Stevie Ray Vaughan and Double Trouble to celebrate their induction into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. I'm Redbeard. In July 1984, I interviewed Stevie in his hometown, Dallas, Texas, for the first of several subsequent interviews. When I informed him that in Dallas-Fort Worth, their second album, Couldn't Stand the Weather, had knocked Bruce Springsteen's Born in the USA out of the number one seller slot there, this was Stevie Vaughan's response to me in the studio.
Maybe we'll get some of these other musicians around Texas to a chance to come out and be listened to.
That's a very good idea. You know, I was talking with somebody about that today. There's a lot of talent in this town and in this area, don't you think?
In this state, there's an incredible amount of great talent that just hadn't got the chance to be listened to yet because they're not mainstream music. But that won't last long.
Okay, you brought up a good point. Why are you the exception? Why do you think that you and your band Double Trouble are having such tremendous success?
Well, several bands opened doors for us.
Mm.
Mr. John Hammond opened some doors for us.
Now, tell people about John. The average people on the street don't know of John personally, but his effect on modern day music is legendary.
Well, he started off putting out records by people like Billie Holiday, Bessie Smith, Duke Ellington.
Basie. He was with Columbia Records for what, like 30 or 35 or 40 years? He made that label, didn't he?
Yeah.
Yeah.
He really did. He's been recording great music for at least 50 to 60 years. 50 years anyway. He's caused us to be able to listen to rhythm and blues or soul music.
Right.
in the, you know, just as a rule, because of him.
Right. He was very instrumental with the careers of people like Bob Dylan,
sure,
getting them on Columbia Records. And
Aretha Franklin.
Aretha Franklin and
Charlie Christian,
so
Bruce Springsteen.
Janis.
Yeah.
Yeah, Springsteen. This is the man you were talking about, John Hammond Sr. Now, how did your talents come to the attention of John Hammond?
Well, the main part of it actually came around when we played the Montreux Jazz Festival.
Ah.
His son played there, too.
Yeah.
John Paul.
Who's done great acoustic blues for years.
He's a great man and a great player.
He is a good picker.
And he brought a tape back to his father, and it just kept his dad's interest, you know. We'd already sent him a tape from a broadcast live out of Austin.
Mm-hmm.
That was a couple of years prior to that.
Mm-hmm.
But it just kept his interest, you know. And we'd been trying to contact him. He'd been trying to get with us. We finally got a deal that made sense.
So
we went for it.
So this is John Hammond Sr. He really was very instrumental in getting you the major label deal, right?
Sure.
Yeah. You've got to swallow hard for a second when you decide to go cover certain classic songs, and you stepped out and decided to cover music that some people feel is just like untouchable, that it just could never be covered. It, guys like some guy named Randy Hansen tried it for a while, and then there's been the Frank Marinos and Mahogany Rushes. But you're the only one that I know that has covered a Hendrix tune and has had Hendrix fans say, "Now that is killer." You did it. You pulled it off. Did you even think twice about it?
All I did was do the same thing that I figure he did with all the music that he listened to.
Oh.
Which is take all the things that were exciting about that music and try to feel them and put them out again.
So,
you know, it's
this really comes from the soul.
Yeah.
On the Voodoo Child.
Sure. I mean, if you don't put that part into a Hendrix song or Albert Collins song or Albert King song or B.B. King song or whoever's song it is, if you don't put your soul into it, you're messing around, not doing anything.
It's a very, very integral part of your music and any real true blues or rhythm and blues, isn't it? Is the soul of the music.
Well, that's what it's for.
You can't see notes flying through the air, but with blues music or rhythm and blues music, you can almost see them, can't you, coming off that guitar?
You see them sometimes.
You see it?
Considered rock blasphemy and career suicide prior to its appearance on 1984's Couldn't Stand the Weather, that's Stevie Ray Vaughan in Double Trouble covering Jimi Hendrix's Voodoo Child. Chris Layton and Tommy Shannon of Double Trouble.
Like a lot of other guitar players, first he was kind of fascinated by all the original type things that Hendrix did that hadn't really ever been done before. Plus he loved the way Hendrix sang too. I think he was also fascinated, honestly, by the fact that the kind of music that he had done and how many people it had reached around the world being done by somebody who was black. Even though you tried to see things colorless, it was like thought that was really cool that Hendrix had achieved this artistic notoriety and commercial success, and not commercial, just monetary success and overall success, like a lot of other people that he always really idolized, never quite got to. And Hendrix had, and that was great.
Yeah. One thing also, Stevie's the only guitar player I've ever heard that can do Hendrix, you know. I've never heard anybody else that could do justice to it. And I don't know, to me it just seems like a part of Jimi Hendrix's spirit was in Stevie.
The Double Trouble Trio had by now expanded to include Reese Wynans on organ. After recording the first two albums in L.A. and New York City, Soul to Soul was cut in Stevie's hometown of Dallas. But I did think it odd that Stevie spent the many months and considerable expense living in a hotel in his hometown rather than at home with his parents. Bandmates Tommy Shannon and Chris Layton reveal why.
And Stevie's frame of mind at that time, I don't think that would have worked out at all, because our addiction was getting worse and worse. So I don't think he'd feel real comfortable around his parents.
Yeah, it was pretty serious. Tom had a pretty serious drug and drinking problem. It was a pretty indulgent record. It caused a lot of problems. We ended up spending a lot of time playing ping pong and just kind of hanging around and doing drugs and drinking. And then we'd go play for a while. And then if we'd hit a snag, it was kind of discouraging. We might go back to play ping pong for a couple, 3 hours, and so it was a dark period. It was, even in the bright spots and what the record ended up being, it was a pretty dark period. It was the most expensive ping pong I've ever played. Charlie Wirtz had Charlie's guitar shop in Dallas, and Stevie had known him for quite a long time. And he's just a great guy, kind of one of the real people, and it was just a great vibe. And Stevie always liked to go in there. Charlie had some kind of cool guitar and say, hey, check this out. Why don't you go take it and play it for a while? And you might not ever even ask for it back, or Stevie give it back to him. He'd keep it for a year, or whatever the case might be. He was just this great guy. He was a real supporter of the band and real down-home kind of guy. And when he died, it hurt Stevie a lot, because he felt like he had lost just one of those people that there weren't a lot of people like him in the world.
They were real tight. I remember that Charlie had this old 57 P bass, you know, just mint, beautiful bass that he didn't want to sell. And somehow Stevie talked him out of it. Stevie carved soul to soul on the bass and gave it to me. He wrote one song for Charlie, Life Without You.
Up next, tremendous acclaim, awards, and success continue to increase for Stevie Ray Vaughan and Double Trouble, while behind the scenes, things actually begin to spiral out of control. Follow In the Studio on Facebook, at Redbeard Rocks on Twitter, and online at inthestudio.net. I'm Redbeard. You're in the studio for part one of the essential best of Stevie Ray Vaughan and Double Trouble to celebrate their induction into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. I'm Redbeard in the studio. It can now be told that the third album, Soul to Soul, had all kinds of problems being made. Make no mistake, regardless of the album and concert ticket sales, the Blues Awards, and the acclaim, by summer 1986, Stevie Ray Vaughan and Double Trouble's Chris Layton and Tommy Shannon had the blues for real. I asked Double Trouble bass player Tommy Shannon, why not chill out and regroup?
Well, for one thing, it goes back to us being real high all the time. You know, we didn't really care for any time off. Everything was getting better, like you're saying, the awards were coming in, and it seemed like we were going uphill. You know, everything seemed like it was working.
We'd also developed this, I guess you could call it the machinery. You know, we had an organization, and Stevie was always great about this equality in treatment of everybody. So there was always bills to be paid. We were making more and more money, and there were more and more bills to be paid. It was kind of like this thing, it's like, well, how do you slow the machine down? How do you just bring it to a stop? And I think we were so wound up in everything that we were doing. It becomes so fast-paced and so tight as far as everything happening day after day that the thought of, like, stopping, it was like, how do you just stop this train that's almost really out of control at that point? And so we just kept on going.
You know, I was running neck to neck with Stevie. I mean, we were both way, way out there. I think I saw it coming before he did, you know. I knew that we were both getting ready to hit a brick wall. I remember him and I talking about it, you know. I think it was in Dallas. I remember we both started crying, and we both got down on the floor on knees and prayed, you know, for help, because we knew we were in real deep trouble. We got up, did some more cocaine, took some more drinks.
From Stevie Ray Vaughan and Double Trouble's 1985 album Soul to Soul, their third, that's Hank Ballard's Look at Little Sister. Plans for a huge international tour and a live album were added to the burden in 1986. The original English manager, Chesley Milliken, was replaced. Maybe now Stevie Vaughan would take a break. Here's author of the Stevie Ray Vaughan biography, Caught in the Crossfire, Joe Nick Potosky.
Taking stimulants was a means of keeping the business going. He was running ragged, but the demands of the business were such that it's time for a new album. Once the album comes out, time to go tour it. And there was no time left to be Stevie Vaughan, the kid from Dallas. It was time to be Stevie Ray all the time. And those pressures built and built and built to the point that after 3 years of relentless running, he was beginning to show the effects of fatigue that even stimulants couldn't help. And so you had the gradual breakdown of the artist physically and creatively. He'd been running on empty for a while and was doing everything he could to keep things going, but basically was losing it. He wasn't treading water anymore. He's beginning to sink.
Then tragedy struck again, this time within the Vaughan clan. Big Jim Vaughan, the patriarch of the family, died unexpectedly August 27, 1986, while Double Trouble was on tour. Already exhausted from a cycle of nonstop touring and recording, certainly now Stevie Vaughan would stop to mourn, to grieve, to pay respect to his father, to tend to Stevie's widowed mother, Martha. Here's drummer Chris Layton.
The night we buried Big Jim, we got on a jet and flew to Montreal, and we did a show that night, and I thought, how can we be doing this? And because I remember when my father had died, it was tragic to me, even though, I mean, I knew he was going to die. He'd been sick for a while, but Stevie seemed like headstrong, I got to keep working. I remember he said, this is what'll get me through. This is what's good for me today. And so he dealt with it pretty good, but I felt like he was also kind of compartmentalizing it and saying, I'll take care of whatever is going to come at me later.
A terrific Big Doyle Bramhall song, Change It, from Stevie Ray Vaughan and Double Trouble's 1985 third album. Here's Double Trouble drummer Chris Layton and bass player Tommy Shannon.
He got to where if he could wake up in the morning and have one drink and just be real drunk. And, you know, it's like he's real confused. He wasn't centered at all.
God, we were in some real small little town in Germany. Stevie and I had been out on the street, and he, like, kneeled down a couple of times to throw up, and it was, like, blood and, like, part of his stomach and stuff coming. I remember there were no bars. There were no drugs, and there were no bars open. And he's like, God, I need a drink. I got to have a drink. And I remember telling him, I said, no, you don't need that. He said, I know, but I got to have one. Anyhow, he kind of regained himself and went back to the hotel, and so we were, the three of us were together, and he'd kind of seemed to kind of come around.
Out of nowhere, he just started shaking. He turned white and started sweating, and we had to call an ambulance.
I remember that, too. I remember looking in his eyes, and it was like the life went out of his eyes for a second. Like, if you've ever seen a dead animal's eyes are like glazed over and you can tell there's no life. It was almost like you could see that. It was almost like some kind of movie or something, some special effect. And then it kind of came back in, and remember he said, I need help. And I knew that something had switched in him, and he was ready to take care of his life, and something, God, some force had brought him back from the edge any longer, and I don't think he would have been with us.
The help Stevie Vaughan finally sought had been available all along. The challenge now was to take life one day at a time. A simple chip is awarded to each recovering alcoholic or addict on each anniversary of sobriety, whether it be a week, a month, or a year. How important is that chip to a recovering alcoholic? Just ask Tommy Shannon.
Yeah, in the program that Stevie and I belong to, that's when Stevie hit his bottom, you know. And they talk about that a lot. You know, you have to reach a bottom where you just can't take it anymore. And it was true for myself. I didn't have a physical breakdown, but it's kind of like when I saw that in Stevie, I knew the old way of doing things was gone for both of us. You know, we both checked ourselves in treatment centers the same day. He was in Georgia and I was here in Austin. But the thing is, there's really a a relief when you hit that bottom. And you know, it's kind of like you surrender to the fact, well, it's got to change. You know, I've got to start a complete new way of life or else die. You know, you have those two choices. It's like each year you celebrate on the birthday. And I still pick him up a chip every year.
That's Stevie Ray Vaughan playing an acoustic 12-string guitar on Doyle Bramhall's Life by the Drop, 2 Corinthians 12:9. Coming up in the studio, part two, Double Troubles, Chris Layton, Tommy Shannon, and biographer Joe Nick Petoskey will be joined by Buddy Guy, Joe Bonamassa, and superstar Eric Clapton. I'm Redbeard in the studio, back after this. This is Redbeard in the studio, thanking all my guests. Don't miss part two at the same day and time next week. In the Studio is written and produced by yours truly for Bearded Fish Productions. Copyright 2015, all rights reserved. Transcription, Jane Carpenter Brunet. Theme song by Andy Timmons. Follow In the Studio on Facebook, on Twitter, @RedbeardRocks, and online at inthestudio.net.